Where would I get the mic?
Yeah.
It's fine.
So while I'm getting wired up, I just like to say that Tom's book, The Triad, has been a very, very interesting publication, also available in the Freud Museum. It is entitled The Triad, Psychoanalysts, Physicists and Kabbalists, and had been translated into French last year under the title of Trois Explications du Monde, and got shortlisted for the best book of the year. So, as Tom's presentation proves, Golem is a very resilient creature, is slouching or marching towards centuries and cultures, and forces its way to science, technology, and art. And we meet him popping up every now and then. Now, how a clinician like myself gets to the legend of Golem, I'd like to invite you to the world of the consulting rooms and talk about bodies, which was one of the very relevant issues of the morning presentation. And just to cut it short, I will be talking about clinical aspects of the Golem story, or maybe Golemic aspects of clinical pictures and the human development. There was a period of my life when I, still in Budapest, I was working with psychosomatic patients and patients suffering from severe identity problems. Working with them made me realize how relevant spatial aspects of psychodynamic phenomena are for our work in our daily practice. They also have essential theoretical and methodological implications. The Budapest School of Psychoanalysis has always been interested in the nature of external and psychic space. Think of Imre Herman and, of course, Sándor Ferenczi. Ferenczi, poetic and profound as he observes, describes the organic relationship that develops between man and the outside world in the stages in the development of the sense of reality, nearly 100 years ago in 1913. And I'm quoting. The infant's mind and the tendency of the adult's unconscious originating from it is primarily preoccupied with bodily satisfactions which are gained from sucking, eating, touching the erogenous zones, functions of excretion. Is it surprising if we will turn towards those things and processes also in the outside world, which, however faint the resemblance may be, remind him of his most pleasurable experiences? This is how those inner and everlasting relations are formed between the human body and the world of objects that we call symbolic. Having taken this way of thinking and these ideas as an integral part of my professional mother tongue, I was interested in spatial aspects of human development from the very beginning. The patients I'm talking about showed me the way to having some insight into the role internal and external spaces play in the processes making possible for us to experience our body as a three-dimensional spatial structure. A structure containing different functional cavities that communicate with the outer world, regulated by appropriate sphincter control. If early infantile development is disturbed or interrupted by traumatic events and object relations, the idea of inner spaces and their representations cannot be adequately formed in the child's mind. In such constellations, the organism is likely to function on a very early archaic level, leaving the door open for pathological development. Words to express such bodily sensations are rarely available. Therefore, metaphors prove very useful in attempts of communicating the affective charge of these earliest experiences. We come to realize that fairy tales offer images that can be used to work them through. And we came to realize it with my patients. They have to find verbal forms to create a language to communicate unconscious conflicts and desires. The idea of a close relationship between fairy tale motifs and bodily symptoms was brought home to me by a 17-year-old girl in analytic psychotherapy many, many years ago, when I was still working in the postgraduate medical school in Budapest. This girl suffered, among other symptoms, of amenorrhea and extreme obesity. She was over 120 kilos. That would be twice as much in pounds, I suppose. She did not look badly deformed, though, and she had a beautiful face. The tint of gold hair cascading down to her hips made her really attractive. One day, she took a heavily used picture book out of her bag, opened it, and started to read her favorite poem, which was called The Song of the Terry Cloth Puppet. In the poem, the puppet claimed how she, the puppet, with her stout and plump figure, was much more precious than any of the beautiful, empty-bodied and headed porcelain dolls, as come whatever may, this one would never break. Needless to say that the terry cloth puppet became a central metaphor in our work, providing us with a significant clue in unfolding the dynamics of her symptom formation and development. Another young girl brought fairy tale elements to reenact a very difficult period in her childhood, which was marked by severe eating problems. At this age, she recalled her favorite heroine was Miss Snowflake, originally in a Russian folktale. This tale started a chain of conscious and unconscious fantasies in her, centering around her wish to shrink so much that she could become a paper girl. In this form, she said she could float freely in the air, slip into places, observe people without being noticed as she pleased. She could behave the way she felt like, sometimes help nice people in need, but most often annoy them or play tricks on them. The third patient coming to my mind, also a young girl of 20, with severe identity problems and anorectic episodes, made me see the importance of these two-dimensional figures in a very explicit way. One day she surprised me by stating very angrily that Pinocchio was an idiot. She told me how being a child she loved this little wooden fellow, but how angry she had been with him making such a fuss about becoming flesh and blood. Rereading Pinocchio to the other day to her little cousin, she suddenly understood what was so upsetting for her in the old days. She said, after all, he could have been as happy as a bird with all his friends and relations protecting him, even when he was really nasty, and yet he was not satisfied. Through all his horrifying adventures and suffering, he was trying hard to be good. Well, he was easily tempted, no wonder. A puppet is ruled by external powers. It does not understand the world. Poor Pinocchio was too stupid to realize that the worst punishment of all was to become real. He was cheated. He was turned mortal. I listened to these tales and became more and more aware of how capable these images are of illuminating different aspects of psychic development and integration. At the same time, I was able to observe psychic defensive maneuvers in their clinical material. Helen, 26, a single woman suffering from anorexia nervosa, presented herself as someone unable to inhabit the spaces she possesses. At the first interview, she looked very pale, skinny. She was under 70 pounds. But what made the most striking effect was that everything she was wearing, even her boots, was very loose, sizes bigger than she needed. At that moment, I simply monitored these facts, the overall importance and symbolic meaning of these clothes I was able to understand much later. She seemed somehow unreal and far away. She complained that she was unable to eat for several days, and then she would have a binge on chocolate, biscuit, and jam. At these times, she ate quantities like a pound of chocolate or a big food jar. She was unable to stop stuffing herself till she felt totally full up, a very painful sensation of pressure in her body. If her mother screamed at her, "You've had enough," she was sometimes able to stop before feeling bad. Her bowels functioned in a similar way. She had no excretion for over a week, and then suddenly, in great pain, she would produce a large amount of feces. She had not had her period for more than half a year. Her fields of activity, both in fantasy and reality, were bound to the territory of kitchen, the bathroom, and the toilet. Looking back at the time when we started analysis, I could say that her body functioned, except for those very short and intensive episodes of pleasure and pain, as a closed space which outer things could not enter and from which inner contents could not leave. Suspended or blocked bodily functions, closed openings, and rigid boundaries, and almost total surrender to outer control were the signs of the impaired ego functioning on a very primitive, archaic level, forcing the organism back to a two-dimensional way of existence. Later, I could interpret this defense as a second trial to achieve the differentiation of the ego from the outer world. In fairy tale motifs, I have quoted before, the fairy tale motifs also describe psychic states in which patients re-experience the struggle for autonomy and control with great plasticity. Let's just think of things like being inanimate, lacking inner spaces, being exposed to the good or bad will of unknown forces, to succumb to external control, not apprehending what and why is happening, restrictive imagination and foresight, changelessness, experience as immortality, and a tickling sense of aggression in the case of the paper girl and Pinocchio. They all belong to this two-dimensional psychic world and illuminate distinct episodes of disturbed psychic functioning. Meltzer, in dimensionality as a parameter of mental functioning, formulated essential features of this world also in relation to change. The self, living in a two-dimensional world, experiences time as circular. Circumstances which threaten this changelessness would tend to be experienced as a breakdown of surfaces, cracking, tearing, dissolution. As if to justify Meltzer's words, my patients revealed that they experienced change like a sudden and unexpected turn of events, an interruption of being, an experience lacking the reassuring sense of continuity which would enable them to trust that growth will be a safe enough process that one can survive, a natural part of life. Fairy tales and legends proved useful again. They provided the metaphors needed to express the affective charge of their fears and desires. Metamorphosis was the typical image they used to describe these internal movements, an irresistible force sweeping them to a different level of organization. Visiting fairy tales and legends associated to the clinical material made hidden links visible and expanded the space for thinking. Putting enchantment in the service of expression was especially important for those lacking inner spaces in the mind for dreaming and imagination. Step by step, I became enchanted by different pictures of metamorphosis encapsulating the experience of mutative changes in the human development. Being turned inanimate was the prototype of transformations in this two-dimensional world. In these stories, the heroes are turned most often into a piece of stone. They become a monument of themselves, retaining their original shape and features. Sometimes they would lose also the shape, being turned into a rock, a piece of ice or hill. The spell is put on them by evil powers, generally infuriated witches. Those who really love them and care about them, represented by good fairies, lovers or siblings, would go to the rescue of these endangered. The motif occurs in tales of different cultures, in many German tales and many Russian tales as well. We are made aware of the horror of such states, but do not learn much of what is going on inside them while they wait for the liberator to come. With heroes born inanimate, like Pygmalion or Pinocchio, the situation is not quite the same. They also have the longest way to go to become alive and human. In these fascinating stories, we learn the hero's lesson, like Pinocchio's lesson. In order to achieve their aims, they have to undergo inner changes. Unless they become able to develop an inner capacity to love and a sense of responsibility, they cannot be saved. Working with neurotics, one gets involved with symbolic stories of a later epoch in mental and emotional growth that are related to more mature object relations. But that is another story. And now, enter the golem. The way is cleared for him to claim our full attention, as it is quite obvious by now that in a psychoanalytical sense, this creature is closely related to the psychic world of early preverbal development. This world is familiar, we have all been there once. I suggest that the force of conscious and unconscious fantasy and memory traces belonging to this very early age is driving us to golems, making us empathize and feel intrigued by the fate of such precarious products of human creation. The golem legend also opens a window through which we can peep into the higher vistas and mysteries of creation and the meaning of human existence. So, allow your imagination to be captured by analogies, like mine was. The golem is a solid body created from mud, does not have the capacity of self-control or expression, it cannot speak, and is exposed to power of its master and creator. Comes into the world by a magic spell, and its whole existence depends upon this external will, which is beyond its comprehension. Golem is turned animate, but with a very limited freedom. Its creation is based on an essential metamorphosis. The golem is catapulted to a basically different level of being, close to the human experience. And exactly here the trouble begins. Can they come closer to the creator? Can they learn how to speak, how to behave? Can they go through mutative changes and have feelings? What if they begin to experience desires and love? What if they fall in love with your daughter, as it happens in one of these legends? And if denied all these, can they get very angry? So angry that they turn against their creator and attempt to destroy. Is it all right if we kill them? Golem can be the metaphor for the different others, as Tom was also talking about it. But we can all ask together that where are the boundaries? Golem, myth, tradition, symbol, inspiration, appears in many guises even today. A metaphor for the individual's need to control the external world, as well as for his quest for autonomy and identity. It symbolizes our mystical past as well as our technology-dominated future. It is shorthand for the creative drive and for both the constructive and destructive aspects of human development, and is therefore especially relevant in the 21st century. This is why a group of us, including Tom, Katalin Bogyai, George Weiss, and Levente Turi, whom you will meet in a second, started to think about Golem as a very powerful and complex metaphor for our times, symbolizing the limits of human creation. Levente formulated his thoughts on Golem like this. He said, Golem is a circa 3,000 years old legend, continuously changing and preserving its meaning. Several varieties of it exist, not only the one originating from Prague, we heard all about it, which is the best known. The golems appear in other nation states like Pygmalion, the Wooden Prince, Kalevala, but it's only the Jewish golem story that presents a change and expansion line which we can follow. At the beginnings of time, the leprous excommunicated old rabbi created a woman for himself. Elsewhere, they created a calf so as to have something to eat. Eliezer, in the 12th century Worms, has made one just for the sake of creation, while Rabbi Lov produced one to defend his community. Traveling little Jews in the Middle Ages created them for escorts. They have all rebelled, of course. Up to the age of Romanticism, it has been the story of meeting needs. Starting from the 19th century, it became the metaphor of a quest for having or owning a personality, presenting itself in an abstract space differentiated from everyday reality in art. In the last 20-30 years, it has become the metaphor of losing the personality. Levant and Tuuri call this process the golemization of man. He is no longer among us. Most likely he is making golems in a different dimension. But we can conjure up his personality and ideas about creation and life by the heart of a film, which we have put together shortly after his death 2 years ago. It was directed by his daughter, Kathleen. And if our dream that we have started to dream together will ever come true, and we'll be able to organize this big international Golem Festival in London with art exhibitions, films, and an interdisciplinary serious conference on biology, cloning, theology, philosophy, psychoanalysis, and history, then that will be devoted to his memory. So, Mitra and Tuuri.
So let's take some questions. Yeah, do you want the mic, or can you hear me?
Hold on, I'm just going to read the rule in the remarks.
Female golems as well, but this element that that the golem is a male creation, there is no women included in that, And that's what put the idea of my mind to write an essay on Frankenstein, Golem, and Pinocchio, as these children, products of male creation, and what it means in our days and in our world, and what is happening to the gender question, as you put it.
John. It can be complicated because in Fritz Lang's movie Metropolis, it's a woman who's in fact created as a machine. So the link between, which is interesting to explore, between masculinities and notions of machining isn't as straightforward as that.
I want to pick up on the other side of this question that Stephen raised, and that is the whole issue of parthenogenesis, the fact that it's a male creation, but created by a male creator solely, as was the very first Golem, who was Adam, created from earth and from mother's world. And then I'd like to bring it back to this snippet that you showed of this beautiful film of the creator, who said, and two went down to the river and they came back three, bringing in the coupling that can create something. And the idea that for certainly some parents, the child that they create is a golem for a long period of his or her life. And with all the projections that I just want to raise.
Pass the mic. There are a lot of ideas going around my mind, stimulated by what we've heard and seen. But I think I want to start at the beginning. What makes a man want to create a golem? And it seems to me he chose some enormous, infantile omnipotence that I can create something, and something that will, unlike my mom or dad, do just what I want him to do, all the dirty work and the cleaning up and everything else, but who's given absolutely no freedom. All based on tremendous omnipotence and control. And it's also somebody, okay, well, I'll come back later. So I'm talking about an infantile creation.
And I just wanted to pick up what Joe said and also this point. First of all, that was so wonderful, and I just want to say that. So rich and so suggestive. The latest version of this might be Ishiguro's Never Let Me Go.
Can you put the
Ishiguro's Never Let Me Go is one of the latest versions of this, I was thinking. But also just to pick up what's already been said, and we're talking about the child's desire for omnipotence. But I think we need perhaps to talk more about parental fantasy, as Joan was saying, because when at one point in the first film, the speaker, Tolkien, spoke about this is someone who will never answer back, and who you can control completely. I thought, rather than child's omnipotence in relationship to the parents, this is a rather nasty fantasy about parents wanting to subordinate, subject, and control their children. And I'm thinking about the extent to which that narrative is also suppressed, partly by psychoanalysis. So we talk about the Oedipus complex, but we don't talk very much about the fact that Laos wanted to kill his child. Right, or Serge Leclerc's wonderful book, A Child Is Being Killed. So I just wonder if there isn't another strand running through this. Hate and the Counter-Transference, Winnicott's paper would be an obvious link here, which is about what parental fantasy is about for children. I think that's sort of what Joan was trying to say.
I just want to bring up one thing that did the dream say he did. He was talking about the other and different kinds of others. And then he talked about mirroring, where you have the ability to tell the difference between the other and the self, you have a double. So I think we should not leave that other concern, that fear, that threat presented by the goal, which is not as the other,
were speaking earlier of the fact that trauma is not sufficiently recognized and acknowledged in psychoanalysis. Did you say that?
No.
You
I just said that the theory, trauma theory,
yes,
has as if disappeared.
The trauma theory?
Yeah. Because we all work with trauma. Don't do any.
Yeah.
Practically, that's the
yes.
most important thing.
But the question was asked about the issue of compensation.
Mm-hmm.
And that left in my mind the notion that to recognize trauma, to acknowledge it, and to pay recompense,
mm-hmm.
whose duty, whose responsibility mm-hmm. would it be? Because if one thinks of the Holocaust, how could that responsibility be taken on by the whole of global world and humanities?
Mm-hmm.
And the other question I wanted to ask you, I'm intrigued in the film what Thomas Sars was doing. Do you know?
What?
What was Thomas Sars doing in the film? Why was he mentioned?
He was, yes. Because he
was... It's just that mm-hmm. in his book he makes a connection and suggests that we should see Freud as a goal. So that's
right.
So on that provocative note, we're going to have lunch. It's been a wonderful discussion. It's been lovely how it's flowed through the room. We meet again at 2:00.